Hello there, I'm Tim and he's John, and this is How to Murder Time, a podcast about games and things.
Hello everybody.
Watcher.
We're back.
We again. Are. We're back with some more chat.
With unrelenting podcasting.
That's the spirit. Keep it regular, that's the key.
Yeah, if you can't be good, be regular.
Okay, I'm going to talk about some games, because that's what I do. I'm going to talk about Plantside 2, which Ooh. Is fast becoming my main game at the moment, which is quite surprising, considering it's a fully PvP first-person shooter.
That is a bit weird for you.
I'm not really a violent sort of person, but I do seem to be enjoying that quite a lot. I picked up some new certs this week.
Okay.
Well, it's the Mines. Mines, you see.
That's Mines. The thing.
Mines. M-I-N-E-E. Yeah, oh. Yeah, you know. As in, you know, devices that tanks go over and blow up.
Not them. Guys dressed in black and white stripes.
That would be awesome.
No, I'll have to look.
There might be a cert for that. Some sort of pretend you're in a glass box type cert. I'm not quite sure how that would help in a futuristic combat scenario. But
it would fox the enemy.
Yeah, no, I'm using mines. I started off with the anti-vehicular mines. Okay, these are both 100 points, and they're available through the engineer utility slot. So you have to be an engineer to use them. You don't just get mines for everyone. And I thought, oh, let's try the anti-tank mines, because I often get run over by tanks and things. Often friendly ones, to be honest, so I'm not sure mines would help in that situation anyway. But it's the perils of being a bloke with a repair gun on foot when there's a lot of hover tanks badly strafing around the place and trying not to get shot, you know.
At head height.
I see so many friendly running overs in the average Planetside 2 Zerg, and it becomes a real art to... they should give the repair gun to the jetpack guy, because then you could just... go straight up if it looks like the tank's going to back over you or something. But no, we're using mines. So I've tried both sorts. There's 100 points, 100 cert points to unlock each one. The anti-vehicular mine unlocks two. This is different to Planetside 1. I always had a lot of fun with the mines in Planetside 1. You got that with the adaptive construction engine, the ACE, which is basically a little nano doohickey that turns into a variety of different engineer deployables. And in Planetside 1, you can put 20 of them down by default in a big old tight pattern on a road or wherever. In Planetside 2, you're only allowed two at once.
That's no fun.
I know, you can...
Don't they know what mines are for?
Exactly. I think you can spend more points to unlock the next rank of that, and it'll let you have three or four, but you're really not talking about laying out huge minefields like in the first game, you know, where you set them out and then go about your business and reap tank blow-up kill points later on. The thing is that they seem to be much more powerful in Planetside 2, though, so you only need a few, but I think it's very much a case of having to tend them. You can't just drop them and go about your business.
You've got to be watering and weeding,
fertilizer, whatever. You've got to be fairly nearby and be able to replace them if need be.
Is it a mechanic where you put them down, they take 15 minutes to build, then you have to refresh them, and
no,
you can take them afterwards and make them into...
No, it takes a second or two. You just drop it straight from your belt pouch. I think you can pay extra certs to have an armor suit slot that gives you more carry capacity. I think that might just be for the C4, which I haven't tried yet. But you put these down, and the big problem is you can't then re-equip anything else to that suit slot, because they'll despawn. Oh. If you put mine number three down, mine number one presumably disappears. So, and that means, because it occupies the same slot as your little pouch of ammo that you drop for people to resupply from. So you can't then go and get one of those and start using that, because it will despawn your mines.
That's no good.
It is quite restrictive, yeah. They're reasonably powerful, but the trouble is you only get so few. You've got to really work well, you know, you've got to really anticipate and make sure they count. I think one or two of them will destroy a lightning small tank from full health in one go if it goes over them. I think it may even destroy the bigger tanks. I haven't really seen that happen with me yet, though. What it will do, two of them will destroy a deployed Sundra, so that's all right. the only real joy I've had with these things is actually running into an enemy deployed Sundra and just dropping it underneath and running away again. And do that twice in a row, and it'll blow the Sundra up completely. But, you know, that becomes a bit of a kamikaze desperation tactic, to be honest. More like sort of running in with a C4, you might as well use that.
I think it's probably a good thing, because we're not meant to support mines, because mines are evil.
Well, they are quite underhanded, I have to say. So I guess with the anti-vehicular mines, you've just really got to time it exactly right. Usually you're looking for a situation where the facility you're defending looks like it's about to be overrun and they're starting to come in with tanks. If you can drop two as you retreat into the buildings in the right spot, you might get a kill or two. But as sort of generalised no-go suppression of vehicles tactics like they were used in PlanetSide 1, they just really don't seem to work that well because you just don't have enough of them. There's no minimum distance between them. You can pop two of them down right next to each other, but like I say, since you only get two, that's not really going to make much odds. So I suppose if you're forethoughted and good with planning, you can do well with those. I had much more success with the anti-personnel mines, though. It's a different sort of mine.
Sort of mine altogether.
Yeah, you get 100 cert points to unlock those, and you only get one of those for your 100 points, one slot, as it were. You can expand that to two, I think, with more cert point spending. But these really are... Well, the thing with the mines in PlanetSide 1, they were basically all-purpose. They would generally one-hit an infantry or do almost all their health if they walked over one. And they do fairly good against vehicles as well. But... the anti-personnel ones, they're really powerful in this one. They will absolutely obliterate an infantryman who steps on one in this game. But you've only got the one. So, and again, the same restrictions. You can't change your slot usage if you've got those deployed because it will unspawn them. So you can't swap to vehicle and put two of those down because that then removes your anti-infantry one. Seems quite restrictive, but it makes up for it in power. And I've started using those in base defences. Oh, there's this awful tower. Last night, actually, this is where I just went on a mad. Every so often, I'll have this plan where I'm going to save up a lot of certs, like 1,000, so that I can buy one of the cool guns or whatever. And then I'll just get this rage moment where I'll just frantically buy something random to try and help.
Did the awful tower have a big glowing eye?
No, it had a big glowing spawn beacon on the top, which was annoying. The enemy jump jet gits had managed to put one of these blue flares on top. Yes, it was the NC. And they can basically respawn on top of the very top of the tower whenever they get killed at that point. And I can't get up there to do anything about it because I'm not very good at jump jets. So the jump pack stuff. In the end, I ended up spawning a plane to go up there and just hover and try and hose the... It looks like a lightsaber handle planted in the ground. Quite a small object that you've got to shoot to destroy. They go away after a while, and those are available in the leadership section of the certs. But every time we were killing these saboteur people, they were just reappearing on top of the tower and jumping down and resuming their sport. And there was this one guy, I don't want to say his name, but my God, he was one of these jump jet people. He was like battle rank 80 or 90 or something. And he had this big skull faceplate mask thing. He'd obviously, and he was just absolutely owning about four or five of us trying to deal with him on this one tower. The whole main Zerg had moved on, and I was just, I was hoping to finish up for the night with a bit of light repair work and then log off. But he just kept coming, and he was just toying with us. And you know it's bad when he gives up using the gun and starts using knife kills for sport at that point. You just think, oh God, I'm just being absolutely humiliated here. So I went a bit mad and spent the 100 points I managed to scrape together on the anti-personnel mines, and I managed to get him. It was brilliant. See, the towers have these grav shafts, the big columns of orange and purple light which go up and down. And
what's wrong with a lift?
I don't know. Well, there are stairs as well. These are lifts. They're space lifts from the future.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And you step into it and it automatically raises you up onto the top and then sort of dumps you onto this landing spot. And that's that one spot that you will always land on whenever you use that shaft. And I just thought, I know. And so I dropped the anti-personnel mine on the landing spot of that. Of course, you can't see the landing spot because you're going up to a platform that's above you. And once you're into the shaft, you can't do anything except land on that spot. So I've developed this technique, which is starting to reap enormous payback and kills. It's great. You just drop the anti-personnel mine on the landing spot from the grav shaft. So, I'm running around frantically trying to repair stuff that these gits have been blowing up. And then I just see this... hear this bang, and then the screen pops up with his name and a kill, and I was in a happy place. It was good. I mean, he then went on to dominate the whole tower for about another 20 minutes and then got bored and went away. But I felt I'd proved my point on principle, I think I had the moral high ground in some fashion. There's some very wildly varying levels of ability in that game, and you just have to be a bit pragmatic about it all rather than rage quit. I mean, you can always go somewhere else, find some less able people to take it out on in return.
That's always a good tactic.
Circle of life, yes. Also, another good thing with these anti-personnel mines is the amp station type bases. We got the ring of big towers and the load of walls. They got these jump pads on the top of them, which work similar to the grav shaft. You step on the jump pad and it automatically rockets you up into the sky and down onto a landing pad, a specific fixed destination landing pad, on the next tower along. And it's great for engineers or people manning wall turrets to be able to get around the base quickly to be in the right place. But, of course, you can't see what you're going to land on when you step on that pad. So I've been dropping the anti-personnel mines on the lone place. I took out one of those big chunky dual chain gun Red Maxes with one of those the last night. That was brilliant. So I think I've found something I can work with, which is good, because the guns are problematic at best. So yeah, very good. If you're the sort of plodding backline engineering type like me, the mines give you more options for getting actual kills. It very much does come into the sort of being smarter, not faster sort of philosophy that I seem to be trying to adopt for this game. You know, if you can think ahead, then you don't necessarily need to be quicker on the draw than the jump jetting git coming at you with a skull faceplate. You know, I mean, there's literally nothing they can do about this mine because they don't know it's there when they step on the launch pad, and they're always going to come down on exactly the known spot. So, and it's about timing in the battle, when they're coming in, when they're moving out, that sort of thing. Judging the greater ebb and flow of it all will help you a lot with mine placement.
I suspect it's griefing, actually.
Well, I don't know. It seems there's literally nothing they can do about it once they step on that launch pad. But I wonder, is that griefing? Is that cheating? Will it get nerfed? Will it become impossible to place mines on these spots? I don't know. We'll see. I'm going to reap the whirlwind while I can, you know. But then there's nothing I can really do about being farmed by people much, much better than me. So I think that's all fair, to be honest. My shaky logic.
Yeah,
I've written hacking there as well. I've had a lot of direct message tweets from Pray for Vengeance, who's fast becoming my PlanetSide 2 mentor. Every time I talk about PlanetSide on this show, he then sends me a lot of direct messages correcting me about what I was wrong about. So things I've now learned.
You get that for all the games, though, don't you?
I get that for a lot. I'm not really knowledgeable about anything. I just talk lots. Yes, the sniper rifle. Apparently, there's nothing you can do to stop it doing the waver.
Oh, that's no good.
The front grip attachment apparently only helps when you're doing full auto on weapons, and it cuts down on the side to side variance when you're full autoing. Apparently, not sure if it helps with up down.
I'd still recommend just resting it on a rock.
Rest it on a rock. Why not? You know, I mean, perhaps they could do that. Some sort of deploy option. Takes a few seconds to set up and a few seconds to unset up. That would balance
it. You know that sniper rifles really just have this sort of A-stand at the front.
Yeah, none of the ones in any of the games I play seem to.
Yeah,
they all have this, you know, you're just holding it, you know, standing up with both hands and looking down the thing, and that's not the way to use a sniper rifle, I'm sure.
Yeah,
not in any of the films.
You should try using the sniper rifle in Dust when you got the level one skill for it.
Yeah.
You're lucky to actually stay pointed the same direction.
It's just waving all over the place, yeah. Oh, I don't know. And then it's a shame, it really is, because I used to be really good at the bolt driver in PlanetSide 1. That was one of the things I got little medals for it and all sorts, so I was actually pretty good at working with that. But this weird wavering thing, and also the default out-of-the-box sniper rifle the Infiltrator gets is very low-powered. It's a sort of semi-automatic thing that you'd need to hit a standard infantry guy about four or five times to kill them with. It doesn't do a lot of damage at all. I mean, obviously, the one-shot, one-kill stuff's all at the top end of the cash shop.
Yeah.
You have to spend 1,000 certs to get that. But the Infiltrator does the hacking. That's why the terminals are the wrong colour sometimes. The Infiltrator has a default option when standing in front of an enemy wall turret or equipment terminal. You just press F or hold E or whatever, and it will change the object to your side. You can also counter-hack those back again, and that's what I've started. That's the thing that's useful to me, because when I take on custodianship of a base, I take it all very seriously. You know, valet, floors need to be clean, everything needs to be stacked up tidily. And terminals that are the wrong colour really irritate me, so that's what I've started actually using the Infiltrator for, purely just so that I can hack them back.
Do you then get XP from them
you
being
do.
Used?
You do.
Good.
No, not from being used. I think you just get one hit of XP for doing the hack. I don't think subsequent people using it contributes then. But so that's certainly something I can be using the Infiltrator for. I had a real good attempt, a couple of hours of trying to be an Infiltrator properly, and it just really doesn't work. The cloak doesn't, it's on a battery charge, and even when you're cloaked, you are still quite visible with a predatory style outline.
Yeah.
Not like the first game where if you stood still with a cloak on, you were actually invisible. But also, the problem with the first game was that a lot of people did video card hacks to make sure that infiltrators could always be seen, and that made it quite unsatisfying. So I don't know if they've gone a different route with what the infiltrator is in the second game. You can't really use it the same way you used to in the first game because the cloak doesn't last long enough and isn't good enough even when it's on. And the sniper rifle's not great out of the box. Obviously, I need to try some of the better ones, see if they help. But you can't have a sniper rifle as a normal infantry guy, which is the way it works in the first game. So you got to go with the stupid cloak suit and stuff. A lot of my kills tend to be cloakers who think they're invisible, and I can see their predator outline, and they've only got like 10 hit points and stuff. And even I can manage to bring one of them down before they pistol me to death most of the time. Sometimes they are that good, but. So, I don't know, I'm just not really impressed with the Infiltrator at all. So, apart from its utility as undoing other enemy Infiltrator hacking, it's not something I'm going to be putting much points into, I think. Something else I need to do more of is actually try some of the cash shop weapons, some of the 1,000-point cert weapons. You have the option for no actual cost, because you're going to spend money on these things, you want to try them out. And so they have this facility. You can actually test weapons out for a limited span. I think you might get access to the weapon for an hour or so, and then it will lock that trial up for another 24 hours or something. Basically, there's a mechanism in there that you can test out each of the guns you could put for a reasonable amount of time to have a go and get some kills, see how they handle, that sort of thing. So I need to do more of that, really, because I've got some station cash saved up, and perhaps some of these guns. I'm thinking that possibly a shotgun might be worth having as a indoor engineer repairy type. It was something I always used a lot of in the first game.
It's always handy to be able to just fill the space in front of you with.
Yeah, when you can't really make that little cross thing line up on their head properly very often, and just being able to blast the entire 90-degree arc in front of you is a good thing. So yeah, I need to do a bit more of the testing there. But in general, yeah, having a good time there. I managed to get squad going with Dr. Torag there, and he very much likes his lock-on missile launcher that he got from the old shop there. It's just great listening to him mumble, terrorising air cavalry and max suits and vehicles. He's really, really, I think he's found his place with it. He's in a happy place. It's sort of brilliant. I left the outfit in the end.
Yeah,
it didn't last. Well, I logged in last.
Left or were kicked?
Left. I mean, I logged in last night to have a look at the message of the day come up, and it's TeamSpeak 3 is mandatory coming up from some date in the near future, and I just thought, I can't be bothered with all this hassle, so I left. I don't think they'll miss me. They're up to 2,300 members now.
It's a select
group. I don't
think
TeamSpeak goes that high, does
no.
it?
No.
So I'm not quite sure what's going to happen there. There'll probably be some kind of large-scale purge and reckoning. Maybe
they probably only have about a 2% active rate.
Well, there's about 150 people on most of the times I log on, but I just thought, it's all right, I'll carry on doing my own thing. Maybe look for another outfit, maybe start my own, I don't know. We'll see. There's a couple of my regular Mumble friends are in there having a go and stuff, so perhaps we ought to set up some mini outfit thing.
You could create one called How to Murder NC.
How clever. Oh, with a TR as well. How to Murder NC and or TR. Yeah, that gets a bit unwieldy, really. I don't know. But I'm loving the game, but yeah, just still feeling my way around and sort of trying to work out what works best for me. But I tell you what, I really do recommend the anti-personnel mines. The anti-tank mines, a bit more hit and miss, you know, a bit less. It's good having a very powerful anti-vehicle explosive at your disposal, but I suspect the C4 detonated whatnots are probably better, because that's how I seem to use the anti-vehicle mines anyway, to run up to a stationary vehicle and drop the underneath them. You get a second or two to run away, which is helpful. But I think the C4 might be a bit more... a bit more precise,
a bit more
designed for the purpose. So I'll have to try and save up and unlock for that next. I think that's 200 certs, and I don't think I've got that far without buying something useless before. It's the sort of impulse buy.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of little small things. The weapon optics and things that go on the top are all like 30 points and stuff, and you can spend quite a long time buying lots and lots of little things, but eventually you'll get to the point where there's only 1,000-point buys left, and those tend to be the actual gun unlocks and so on. So I'm just not sure I'm good enough to generate vast amounts of certs in one session. I can generally get about 100 certs a session, including the overnight stuff from the last session as well. So it's doable, and you know what I'm like with stubborn point saving up exercises in these games. I will get there.
And then you'll go nuts.
I'll go nuts and quit as a result of it, absolutely. But yes, it probably is playable without putting too much cash down. But I'm finding that a lot of my kill win, you know, the big screen that comes up when you're killed by so-and-so using X gun, the guns listed there tend to be quite impressive and powerful and cash shoppy stuff. And I'm thinking that it's going to be hard work and you're going to have to be quite stubborn to just get by with the basic gunnery it gives you with each default class. Yeah, so, you know, as intended design, it's playable without putting cash down, but better if you do. So that's not a bad system. I think that's all right for me. I'll get there. So let's see, Guild Wars 2. I've written Teppo, Hero of Tyria. Yeah, so we've finished a lot of the map completion-y stuffs in all, and we're all gearing up to go for the big end-game dungeon raid on Arar to finish all our personal stories. Only Teppo is a bit far behind on his story, so we've been helping him do that, which mostly consists of him doing his solo personal story with us lot in the group as well helping, which makes them all considerably easier, it has to be said. And then us heckling him in cutscenes, which for some reason he's decided to keep to go through with no clothes on.
Okay.
I don't know. He's a strange man. But I have to say, the unresolved sexual tension between his character and Marshall Traherne is getting almost unbearable, to be honest. It's making for some quite uncomfortable scenes in these cutscenes. Put some damn clothes on. Anyway, so we're nearly there. Looking at where he is and which chapter he's on and what bits he's doing, I think we probably need another three or four missions and then we're ready to go for it. I have to see if we can hunt around and recruit some of the other people who've adventured with us over the months to give us a hand with the Arar thing. But we will do it. And then I'm still not complete, apparently, because I did some research, and apparently the 100% map completion thing is not only what you need for the star.
Ha-ha.
Yeah, you see, your players are running around with the little star next to their names are the ones who've done world completion. Now, that involves the 100% map completion, but also you need to have explored every overland region. And these are held separately in the achievements window on the hero screen. And there's a big old list, and there's a green one called Explorer, and there's five categories at the top, which are Aurean Explorer, Ascalonian Explorer, etc., etc., for each of the regions of the game. And to max out those title tracks, you need to have visited every single fuzzy bit of map. Okay. A bit like the first game.
Yeah, just like the first game. Are you going to have to use Photoshop in this one as well?
It's not nearly as bad in the second game. In the second game, the map uncovers in distinct named regions. And apparently I'm missing one from Maguma and two from Shiver Peaks. God knows where those are. I'm going to have to sit down with a wiki and go through lists and compare against my world map and so on. I'm not expecting that to be a technical challenge. It's just a question of trying to work out where I've been and what I'm missing, and then go to those places, it'll uncover the map and those will be done. But I still haven't got the Eternal Battlegrounds yet. This week's redraw gave us a section I've already explored, so we're going to be at least another week there.
Do you have to fill in all the gaps on that as well?
Yes, I think so. I think those maps are already pre-uncovered for you for PV for the World v World stuff, so that's not so bad. It's not a difficult thing. I just need to sit down and take the time to work through the lists from a wiki or something, and that'll be sorted out. And then I'll get my star, and then I'll just need the personal story finishing. Then I can stop playing.
Hooray!
But we'll come back to Guild Wars 2 later. Let's talk about Enslaved Journey to the West.
Oh, yes.
You lent me that, didn't you? I was casting about for a bit of a 360 adventure, and you recommended that.
Yes, it's an interesting game with a lot of green and Andy Serkis. What more do you want?
It is a very good game. I'm enjoying it a lot, actually. It's essentially a third-person platform combat-y type of thing, set in some bizarre post-apocalyptic future where New York is all overgrown with greenery. And
it's a lovely New York.
It's fantastic design to the early levels there. Yeah. You're some sort of nomad wastelands wanderer type, and it's a very hectic opening tutorial section there.
It is, isn't
when
it?
You're on that slave transport.
Especially when you're climbing along the outside.
Yeah, and it's rotating and stuff. Bits are falling off after you've leapt off of them and stuff. It is really exciting, and I was almost overwhelmed by it all, to be honest. But yeah, that sort of sets the scene. You're essentially some nomad wastelands wanderer called Monkey, with some awesome hair, I have to say, and a big staff weapon and some gloves and stuff. and you end up escaping from this slave transport. It's not explained why you're on there, at least not the bit, not as far as I've got yet. And this other young woman called Trip is also who's basically running through hacking systems, and that's how you manage to end up tumbling out of there. And you end up clinging onto the outside of her escape pod as she escapes from the burning wreck of this thing. And then
it's a brave way to leave,
banging on the window. And then so you end up waking up in the ruins, and she's put this headband on you, which is essentially a kind of slave control thing. She can issue commands with it or kill you with it if she wants. Although that's, see, I was assuming that Monk, the character of Monkey there, was some horrific serial killer nightmare man, but he just seems like a man who's in the wrong place at the wrong time. And he takes the whole headband thing extremely philosophically early on. You know, initially he's quite cross about it, but that fades away very quickly, and you end up in this sort of,
he's not the monster.
She's
the monster.
Yeah, you end up helping through this city and stuff. So the basic gameplay through the city and out and beyond is a sort of a series of platform puzzles, a series of puzzles involving robot sentry guns and some quite hectic combat as well. Quite button mashy, I'm finding. But really good, really well done. I've written Prince of Persia there because the whole experience, you know, very early on with essentially you helping the young waif through the ruins and fighting the monsters for her and stuff is all very familiar. I'm thinking particularly of the Prince of Persia 2008 one with Elika and the Aram and shadows and everything. And just the way that you're having to use this NPC to help you through the puzzles and help the NPC through as well. It's almost like a massive ongoing escort quest, but quite a manageable one. I mean, she gets this EMP burst ability that will let her shut down a robot if it gets to her. So you've got a certain leeway on some of these, you know, the sort of turrety based.
Yeah, you can make a mistake, yeah, and it doesn't kill you.
It doesn't punish you too badly. You can't get too far away from her, but on the whole, I mean, you seem to strike up quite an equitable relationship very early on, and she's very helpful as well as being, you know, not a bad escorty as it were as well. So normally you get really sort of fed up with these sorts of awful escort quests that appear in MMOs and elsewhere, but this seems more of an integral partnership, I suppose, much like in the Prince of Persia game. She's quite a tech genius and is up giving you an opportunity to upgrade all your gadgets and abilities and stuff as you go through. Got this cool dragonfly drone thing. She's scouting out dangers.
I like the dragonfly. The dragonfly was good.
Dragonfly's cool, yeah. So like, you know, she's marking mines on your HUD so you can see the activation radiuses, that sort of thing.
Catching the dragonfly wasn't good.
It's a ridiculous jumpy puzzle to get to it, and it keeps scooting off. Yeah. I don't know how far I'm through, really. We've got to a village and things have happened, but now we're off into the wastelands on his cool motorbike. So I don't know how far through I am.
You're more than a little way in, but not quite at the end.
Very helpful, thank you. Yeah, but I'm enjoying it a lot. I mean, there's a certain... The combat feels good. It feels quite gutsy. I mean, it's quite tricky as well. I'm finding that just button mashing isn't doing it. You've got to be quite clever with positions. Some of the robots have got shields and so on. I'm loving the setting. The setting's brilliant. It's sort of very minimalist. There's, you know, everything's gone to hell, presumably 500 years into the future or whatever. And there's all these killer robots everywhere, and we don't know why. And there's people eking it out in a sort of almost Mad Max style isolated communities. And you got the monkey, who's clearly the sort of road warrior of the piece. He sort of wanders from settlement to settlement, who seems to have gotten drawn into it all. I'm really fascinated to find out more about the world and the setting, which is good. Very, very engaging. I like it.
Yeah, it's good.
And the puzzles aren't too bad. They're not too brain-racking. It usually gives you enough pointers and advice. A lot of the ledges you're supposed to leap onto to make progress seem to glisten a bit so that you can actually see where you need to be, because the world's really detailed. And you sort of soon realise that if there weren't those glittering clues on each ledge, you'd have absolutely no idea where you're supposed to go next, because each wall is so gloriously detailed. Pretty much anything could be the thing you're supposed to climb on.
It does have gorgeous art design.
Yeah, it's very, very good design to it all. Yeah, the music's fantastic as well. Andy Serkis as Monkey as well, doing a very creditable Marcus Fenix impression for some reason. I thought he was English, but there you go. I don't know who does Trip, whose voice that is. I'll have to look it up.
It's somebody relatively famous.
She's a very credible and believable character as well.
Question is, has it made you want to go and watch the 70s TV show again?
No, I'm aware of Journey into the West is essentially a sort of, I don't know, Far Eastern, almost mythological thing along the lines of the Arthurian legends and so on. It's quite a quite a well-known story told many times and in many incarnations. I think it probably has. I remember getting to the cloud, the first cloud level. Monkey gets his cloud out. You know, what the hell? Hey, what? He's like, oh, the cloud works here. What's the cloud? Hey, what? And so next thing you know, you're scooting around on this little Mekon-style floaty energy thing and doing all sorts of crazy jumps around this harbour, and it's fantastic. And then it sort of, he's, oh, it doesn't work here now, and puts it away again, and off you go back to the normal gameplay. It's like, what? What the hell was that all about? But the cloud is awesome. But yeah, I'm liking that a lot and finding it really drawing me in as well. It's not too technically challenging as a sort of puzzle platformer. You won't find it too difficult to get the timing right and find out where to go next. I don't know if you can turn those glistening ledge cues off or not, make it a bit more challenging, but very good. So playing quite a bit of that. And I imagine I probably will just blast on through to the end, to be honest.
Trip is played by Lindsay Shaw.
Okay, I'm not quite sure of her previous canon, but I don't.
It's TV, Body Approved and stuff. Mm-hmm. The Howling Reborn.
none of this is ringing any bells, but that's fine.
Yeah, don't know.
She's very good. I've written Guild Wars there. Yes, we're still dipping into Guild Wars a bit here and there.
That's still going.
It is still going, yeah. And to be honest, I think that'll be going long after Guild Wars 2's run out of ideas.
It will.
Certainly what I'm finding, anyway. If we were just chatting about this, I popped in to just do a bit more of the Winds of Change, which is a massively long quest chain covering almost all of factions. And that's great. Pays out well as well. You're getting sapphires and rubies and lockpicks and all sorts for that. And those are big ticket cash items.
And scorpions?
Scorpions? No. Okay. There is a skill called Scorpion Wire that the assassin has.
You should use that while you do Winds of Change.
I see what you did there, and I'm going to ignore it. I was doing some of that, and then a couple of the others popped up on Guild Chat, and so we ended up going off and doing Abaddon's Mouth, which is the last mission of Prophecies. This is for Trinity, who's sort of catching up with some of the end game stuff. And it is a really technical challenge. It is quite a difficult mission, that one. It was basically the end of PvE content for the original launch of Guild Wars. And the mission that you have to do is really quite fraught. There's a lot of level 28 fire monsters in there. This is all in normal mode. And there's to get the bonus objective for that, you've got to go and find a particular NPC who's right off of the beaten track for the main mission path walkthrough. And as soon as you get into like aggro radius of that NPC, they get attacked by a load of giant fire monsters. So you've got to rush in and try and save it before it dies. Otherwise, you won't get given the bonus objective. The bonus objective then involves killing a load of really giant fire monsters in addition to shutting down a load of portals that you were there to do in the first place. And that all takes place in a big old sort of amphitheatre type valley, and there's so many patrollers going through there that it's very easy to over aggro and get wiped out on that last section. And it's that sort of design of Guild Wars 1, which always, you know, I mean, I don't say many bad things about Guild Wars 1, but there are a lot of missions in there where it will take you half an hour to 45 minutes to find the bit that will wipe you. And when that's happened,
I don't enjoy that.
When that's happened to you, you're not immediately inclined to leap straight back in and start again, you know. So we have a lot of knowledge. We've done this mission before, so we have managed to fry quite a good running walkthrough and got the thing done with no hassles at all, which is good. I've written Malix there as well. Me and Malty ended up having another crack at the Ebony Fortress of Malix, which is essentially the post-end game top-end raid content for the Nightfall expansion. We did all right. We had to go with the concept. There are three items that you can buy from particular NPCs on Embark Beach, which between them give you a huge amount of buffs in almost every category. Activation timers, attribute scores, armor, health, mana regeneration, everything. Trouble is, each of these items costs one skill point each. Ooh. As well as a whole bunch of materials. And yeah, you'll get a new skill point every time you refill the level 20 bar, and most people who haven't been doing the Elite Skill Hunter have got about 400 or 500 of these skill points left. So it's not a major hassle, but they're just the sheer transformation those buffs give you in the end game content is amazing. I mean, we had absolutely no trouble with the first section of the last Malix quest involves two rooms. There's a Stonehenge-y thing you appear at to begin with, and it sends about 19 waves of really quite harsh end game stuff at you, Marganites, demons, and so on. And they're on they're mostly on a sort of timer with some triggered waves, but you've really got to be burning them down quite quickly to keep in control of that whole thing. Then it lets you through into the main fortress, where there's the big boss guy who calls in reinforcements on the usual certain amount of hit points bars. Then also he's got four spirits behind him who all do different environmental effects which make life hard work. Things like you take damage if you move, things like every time you use an auto attack you lose energy, and yeah, just the whole problem of it all was mostly him, though. He's this giant sort of semi-transparent purple shimmering gorilla monster who comes stomping around the place and hits really hard, and also has this special monster skill that he can turn any hexes you hit him with into healing.
Ah.
Yes, and of course, being a Mesmer...
How long did that take for you to realise?
we were at it for about half an hour before I realised that my entire skill bar was basically healing him quite extensively and keeping him alive.
Were you playing for the wrong team at that stage?
Yes, I was negatively helping again. It's something I do quite a bit. So we're going to have to go away. Basically, the standard seven heroes with the Minion Master and the Ritualist Necros and the Panic Mesmers and everything, the standard meta build that's on the PVX wiki doesn't really work in there, and we ended up trying all sorts of crazy experiments involving paragons and skill bars with warrior skills in that we had no idea worked. So basically, we're going to have to go away, do some research, and come back to that. But it's good to still have goals.
Yeah.
It's good not to run out. Malix will die one day, but probably not this day or any day soon. We need to do a bit more work there. He's a really complicated and tricky boss. It's not so much in the dance aspect of it. It's more just the monster skills he's got and the interruptions that are needed, and trying to work with these deployed global effect spirits as well. We try killing those, but they seem to respawn when they die, so you just have to
push. That's unsporting.
Yeah, you just have to push through it and work on skill bars that can ignore the effects they're piling on you. But it's just interesting to see how much life's still in there, so I imagine I'll keep chipping in with Guild Wars every now and then. I've written Tor question mark on my little running order there. I've received a number of Twitter comments and harassment, essentially, that people keep thinking I should go and play the Old Republic. They were getting quite cross that I forgot about it when I was listing my What Shall I Play Next. So I don't know. I haven't even gone near it yet, but I'm increasingly thinking that I'm probably going to have to download the client and give it a go at some point. But
I started it this week, and client actually patched up, the original client.
Is it still going?
No, it's finished. I left it overnight, and I have a fully patched up client. I logged in for a second and thought, oh yeah, this is Star Wars.
No, but I'm seeing various people say that they're still playing The Old Republic and enjoying it a lot.
The single player is good.
Yeah.
Do not treat it like an MMO.
I am quite partial to a standard BioWare single player story game, you know, single player RPG. Have you seen that chart?
Yes.
I have to have that at hand when I'm playing through The Old Republic. I've heard that, and I've heard also people telling me that The Secret World is very good. So it involves a lot of puzzle-type gameplay. I think people are picking up that I don't really dig combat much, or I'm not good at it, or whatever. But I don't know. It'd be a toss-up between those, I think. But I'm still really not done with Guild Wars 2 quite just yet. It'll be another couple of weeks. But after that, I don't know. Probably The Old Republic's something I need to look at, yes. Absolutely. I'm not sure what I'll do with that, or what I'll even be allowed to do on the cheap seat ticket, which I'm obviously going to go for. I shall probably be Imperial, because they've got the correct and interesting accents.
Yes. That's true.
Yes, the Brits, the Imperials are basically British. And I don't know, I'm smuggler or inquisitor or whatever the hell. I just don't want to be a Jedi, you know?
Half the classes are Jedi.
Yeah, yeah, it's just the sort of Mary Sue of it all, you know. I'm the chosen one with my special glowy sword, and I have magic powers, and I'm this, that, and that. No, I just want to be someone a bit somewhat interesting, somewhat pragmatic and grounded in the real world. I'm thinking if there's any kind of spy class or smuggler, perhaps, something like that, might have a look.
I think smugglers are good guys.
Smugglers are the Republic, are they?
Yeah, I think so.
I'll have a look. I shall Imperial agents.
Actually, bad guys, because the good guys are bad guys. Yeah.
Apparently I heard good things about that story. I remember reading various blogs as people were playing through it back when it was fresh and interesting, and a lot of people were saying that the smuggler and the Imperial agent were both quite interesting. Mm. Do put your thoughts in the comments for this post for this show, because I shall probably need some guidance about where to go and so on.
You better start downloading it now, actually.
Yeah, maybe. All right, I'll crack on with that. All right, and what have you been up to?
I have been up to many, many things. I have been playing Dust.
Okay, yeah,
which is still, I like to say, under NDA.
Oh, you're fantastic. I've seen people on Twitter going on and on about, oh, I hate NDAs, I'm playing this game, it's really good. Yes, we know you're playing Defiance, for God's sake. Just get on and spill the beans.
Yeah. Anyway,
what's Dust. The matter? They're not going to invite you to their next beta.
I think Dust comes out of NDA this week, which is annoying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, Dust is...
not that you care.
I'm still enjoying Dust. Yeah, what are they going to do, kick me out?
Yeah, exactly. Bleh.
Yeah.
It's all paid testing anyway.
Oh, I had a brilliant moment yesterday.
Yeah.
It was me and this guy. I was really, really, really damaged at this point, because, you know, that's my default state.
Previous battles had not gone well.
I just barely survived a fight. I came around a corner, saw a guy walking up the stairs towards me with one of the big guns.
Oh, God, that's always a nightmare.
Luckily,
now
he must have been on a controller.
Oh.
Because his aiming was all everywhere, and I was on a mouse and keyboard. You cannot play this game on a controller.
Does the huge big gun have, like, crazy all-over-the-place recoil or something?
Well, no, it just takes so long to aim and get... You haven't got the accurate aiming that well.
Okay. Because you think he was on a controller? Well, obviously, most people playing that are going to be on a controller. It's a PS3 game.
No, you need to play it on keyboard and mouse. Do not play it on controller.
That's not difficult to set up or anything.
Everyone play it on controller.
Everyone else play on a controller.
No, you just plug a keyboard and mouse in.
Standard PC one, USB, whatever.
Yeah, I've got my USB wireless
so top tip there.
Microsoft mouse that I'm using.
Plus it makes using the chat channels easier, I imagine.
It's just a bit awkward.
Mm, okay.
But yeah, which is really good now, because, you know, I got the whole alliance in our chat window.
Yeah, you were saying they'd managed to do something, and now it's connected, the chat's connected to proper EVE online.
It is, yeah.
So you can talk to people in EVE online from Dust and vice versa.
Yep.
Excellent. That is very interesting. I don't think many games have done that. I know a lot of the Sony games, there is the capacity to talk to people, say, in Vanguard from EverQuest 2, if you put the right tell parameters in.
Yeah, but these two games which are effectively connected.
Oh,
you can chat between them, and there are actions you can do which affect between the games.
It's much
especially
more relevant
shooting
here,
the planet, which is interesting. I've not done it yet.
Okay.
And not seen it yet.
Yeah.
Because I'm still...
The orbital strikes from EVE players.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
I'm still a little annoyed that they reset the skill points and I had to start again back as a
noob. That's what you pay for when you do a free beta.
I knew they were going to do it. It was just still annoying. So I'm slowly building up my...
You should use this opportunity to just try out everything, because there's bound to be a reset before it goes properly.
I think they won't do another reset. They did a reset when they joined it together.
Okay.
And I think you're probably okay now.
Oh, you're just going to keep stuff from beta and move straight in?
I assume so. Maybe not. But yeah, at the moment I've been... Yeah, clawing my way back up the assault rifle. And it's sort of like the hand-to-hand combat, plus 10% damage to hand-to-hand.
Do you punch many people in this game?
Yes, you. In every first-person shooter, when you're running towards someone, your ammo runs out the last second, you want that last punch to try and put it over the edge.
Okay.
But yeah, that's going to be an extra 50%, I guess, so that'd be good.
Mm.
Yeah, it's still good. I'm still enjoying it. The skirmish mode was down a lot yesterday, so that just wouldn't start for me. But the ambush mode, there's two different modes. There's the capture the flag modes, where you're capturing different spawning points
and
resources. And there's also the just plain so many deaths on each side.
Okay.
Right.
Bit of variety.
And the deaths on each side one was the only one that was working for me yesterday.
Hmm.
Which is still good, you're just running around. People are using tanks.
Oh, okay.
Which is annoying when they run you over.
Well, yeah. You have to buy them with your in-game...
Yep.
Money, do you?
Hmm. I actually made a build of in-game money, real money equipment.
Okay.
And then I stopped using it after a couple of seconds. So I realised after I lost 5 of my 50 items for each one in the first 10 minutes of that one
fight.
This
is what makes me cautious with consumables like tanks and stuff in these games.
And like PlanetSide 2, I think that in this one you can make do with the starter gear and still be quite good.
I think there's a certain amount of skill element involved in the starter gear in PlanetSide 2. I know I'm not that great at the game but in general, but I think you do have a significant edge if you've got the heavier gear, I think.
You have an edge, but I think that's stuff like if you're on a one-on-one with someone, you're going to lose, but if you're coming in on the side of another fight or they don't see
I don't think there's any gear you can buy. Well, I don't know. Like I said, having seen one guy manage to suppress about 5 to 10 people defending a tower and just start using the knife for style bonus, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Skill is a huge part of it.
Yes. Also, I played some MMOs.
Oh, gosh. What are you doing
Just including me logging into Old Republic. First off, I've been playing quite a bit of Star Trek Online, actually.
Yeah.
Well, because you left,
I'm all right.
We can all go
it's
back.
It's fine.
And so the entire corps
Yeah, you buggers have all decided to rekindle the game and all start doing happy, fun, together things in that game just after I burn out of it all. Yes, most inconsiderate. Still, I know, my problem, not yours.
Well, Ark said that we had a star base, so I had to go look.
Well, I was chipping away at some of that when it first all came out, but it just seemed like such a monumentally futile task for one player to try and build up and maintain a star base. It's content that's clearly designed for, you know, 20 or 30 people chipping away at it regularly. So, apparently there's new stuff there now, is there?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yes, and we're slowly... There's 6 bazillion different consoles and people on the space station. At the moment, I think 3 of them work.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that was my first impressions of it all. You know, there's loads of people and things in there, and you talk to them and say, this is not available yet, go grind more. And it's like, oh, I'm an admiral, you can't talk to me like that. But apparently they can.
Yeah, they can.
Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting still. Still hate the ground combat.
Yeah, yeah.
But the space combat's still brilliant, so I've been just floating around space, blowing stuff up.
I don't know. All I know is that Star Trek Online is a nice skating simulator that I burnt out of.
Yeah. Mm. I avoided that completely.
I noticed, yeah, you made me watch while you did some duty officer stuff and ran around and stuff, which I thought was particularly cruel. I was whimpering away in the corner here. And I noticed that there's quite a lot of Breen spaceships about.
There's an awful lot of Breen spaceships.
Yeah,
about.
Yeah. Have you seen that in other sessions recently as well? Oh, bloody hell.
I don't think I've been anywhere where there hasn't been a Breen spaceship.
Please put in the comments of this podcast show if you managed to get a Breen Check Gel spaceship as well, because I just don't believe the number of people who actually sat down and ground through it all.
And are still playing.
And are still enjoying the game as a result. Yeah. And perhaps I'm different than strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's still a good game. It's just, it's so grindy.
Yeah.
So I'm inevitably going to burn out at some stage.
Well, yeah, that's it. But is the Romulus stuff not doing it for you?
Not really. It's running around on ground, see?
There's a lot of space-based...
scanning stuff, then jump by Tholians.
Yeah, there's a lot of space-based stuff in the same sector block, though, the different planets you visit and so on. I mean,
I've been enjoying the daily fleet battle one.
Yeah, yeah.
Patrol stuff.
It's a very casual game these days. Yeah, my own hatred notwithstanding, but it just definitely seems based around little 10-minute activities, and then they're quite happy if you go away.
Yeah.
New style of MMO, perhaps.
I've mainly been doing the... duty officers.
Yeah, yeah, you set your duty officers, you do one mission maybe that takes 5-10 minutes, and then you're done, really. Because
Ark posted a thing about how to get them, and it just got me thinking, oh yeah, there's loads and loads of the multiple story arc ones I haven't done. So I started trying
change
to get those.
Duty officer missions that you do successive stages of with a bigger reward at the end.
Yeah, I thought I should try and do some of those, because they unlock a good thing at the end, so I'm working through those.
Okay.
I unfortunately just get to the point where they take 7 hours to do. So that's one day, So, yeah, so slowly.
Well, you know, each to their own.
I also got myself a lockbox ship.
Oh, yes, yes. I was aghast that you'd attempted the lottery.
No, I didn't. I bought
it
off the exchange.
Oh, yes. Because these are, the Mirror Universe vessels of all different shapes and sizes, which are basically the same as the Starfleet
ones, but yellower. On a tip from Arnor, because he was talking about it, was the fact that apparently everyone wants the temporal...
I found out in a blog post some while back, did some research, and apparently you got a 0.4% chance of getting one of those per key spent.
Yeah, and each key's
you've got about a
5%
chance of getting a Mirror Universe, not quite as good as the real thing, Federation yellow-trimmed vessel. And apparently no one wants those, they're all after the other thing.
So I grabbed one off the exchange for 80,000.
Which is functionally a pittance. My character is not particularly... mercantile. It's got a couple of 100,000 energy credits knocking about, nearer a million, I think. So these things are literally going for an in-game pittance for an end-game character.
Yeah. You can get the temporal ships for about 5 million.
Well, the keys go for about 1 million, so that's absolutely a bargain.
Yeah, it's a lot to get it off the exchange than to go through the other
you're
way.
You're absolutely not going to get a temporal science vessel with 5 keys.
No.
So if there's one on the exchange for 5 million, buy it, yeah. And then just, I don't know, buy 5 keys from the shop for your $5 or whatever, I think they're $1.25. Put those on the auction house for 1 million or whatever they go for, then take that money and just buy the spaceship you want.
Yeah.
Which will cost you about $5 instead of about 312, I think I worked out.
It's something like that, isn't it? Something scary
like
that.
And that's not a guarantee, you'll get it even then. So yeah, that seems to be the way to do it. Let other people roll the dice and then just pay them for the reward.
Yeah, we're not really selling the game there.
I'm not selling lockboxes. They're just a curious thing. They're there, I can ignore them.
Best thing about lockboxes is there's now 4 days left till this one goes away.
Oh, those science vessels will probably go up and up in price then. Or they'll just appear in the cash shop for a straight fee.
which I should probably do anyway.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, leave it 2 years.
I don't care. It's Star Trek Online, and I have nothing to do with that game anymore. Uh-huh.
I saw that look in your eye when you saw all of those progress bars.
Involuntarily twitch there, yes.
Those progress bars we've got to fill.
Such a simple, predictable creature.
Yeah. Moving on to another.
Let's talk about something else, yeah.
I logged into Lotro.
Lotro? What? You don't... What? I don't even...
Well, you see, after the conversation we had about points, yes. And how many points do I have?
Oh, gosh, yes.
So I actually logged in.
You went in to have a look how many turbine points you got.
And so I bought the latest expansion with a tiny fraction of the points I've accrued.
They really badly miscalculated with that whole lifetime deal back in the day, didn't they? They thought, ooh, lots of free extra cash right now. And they didn't really sort of think that people would still be hanging off of that 5 years later and still giving them no money ever.
Yeah. They lose. Sales for it at this point.
I almost everyone I know, knew back then went off and got the lifetime thing, and just I probably could count on two hands how many people were just paying the standard monthly way back then, and then it all went free to play anyway, but they were left with this awkward grandfathering thing, and suddenly they're having trouble.
Lotro really was
burning
a good
up the
deal
points
with
they
the
have
lifetime.
To keep giving people free. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
So I wandered around brief for a while, got bored.
Well played. So you went and bought what, Rohan, and you know you've got to get to like level 75 or something to even look at the horse combat.
I was maxed out when it was maxed out at what, 65?
Yeah. Well, you've got to get in. Yeah. I popped in briefly a while back and was doing a bit here and there, and I got to 66 with my guardian, but I still got about another 9 levels to before I can go and look at the special super mounted combat, which apparently is very good. I mean, Multi there's playing it a lot and says a lot of good things about it. I just literally have no idea what it's like. I'm sort of picking up some vague notions that it's a bit like ship combat in Eve or Pirates of the Burning Sea. I mean, you're setting speeds and things, and I have literally no idea.
I'll probably find out. I'll probably get there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you've got the quest packs, it'll be a lot easier getting through Dunland and the Gap of Rohan.
They cover the expansion, don't they?
The Rise of Isengard expansion, I think, probably includes the content that goes
if
with
If not,
that.
I've got so many points.
Well, basically,
left over.
I don't have the Rise of Isengard, and for me, there's nothing to do in that area. Yeah. I've just got to do the same 4 skirmishes over and over until I hit 75. Or spend some money, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm that committed to Lotro at the moment, though. That's probably not where I'm going next. It'll be the Old Republic or Secret World, who knows?
Yeah, I'm not going to be playing this very much.
No thoughts of getting the band back together then?
No. Now, the game changed beyond what
the
I enjoyed.
The epic storyline that I've seen so far, that is, you know, that I've been high enough level to attempt through Isengard, is absolutely solo content.
I know, it's
they've
sad,
rejiggered
really.
It all, but to become solo. I mean, the dungeons are for groups, and they're still there, I guess.
Yeah, and I just didn't enjoy the dungeons in that game.
No, they were far too gimmick and dancey. We did the Grand Stairs over and over, and that was all right, but only because we understood the dance for that one, and it was
easy.
Having to learn new ones every time, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dunno.
Yeah, so.
So you're probably not really. So you got enough points left there to buy all content that exists at the moment?
I don't know. I've got thousands left.
Okay.
So yeah,
spend it all on hobby horses. That'd be all right.
I could do. I might just wait until the next expansion to get that as well.
Mm-hmm. They're probably heading off to Minas Tirith at some points next, I suppose. I don't know what time scale we're looking at, though.
Year and
six
a half.
6 months to,
2 years.
To 18 months, something like that. Yeah.
It's not going to be 6 months, I don't think.
No, I imagine they got a lot more mileage out of Rohan first.
Yeah. Next, I was playing Anno Domini 2070, or whatever the number is.
2050, isn't it?
50,
2070,
know.
Yes, it is 2070. Yes, yeah. Yeah, I saw you playing that.
Yeah, I only started playing that today because it was on offer on Steam.
It looked really good.
I let it download overnight. And I do like that kind of game. Yeah. I really love the building.
It's essentially a sort of empire building, resource management, micromanagement. Is it actually an RTS as such? I know it's real time, but it didn't seem to be any combat of the stuff you were showing.
I haven't had any combat yet. I've seen guns.
There's a lot of setting up tree farms and processing plants and smelters, and it's a lot of floating arcologies on giant boats, which look quite cool, and submarines. Looked really good.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I can't say much about it because I've only done 3 missions out of the campaign.
Yeah.
But I am enjoying it, and it was cheap, so it was good.
Is that a Steam deal of some sort?
It was a Steam deal. And the only problem being, I didn't check to see who published it beforehand.
Yeah.
And it's Ubisoft, so bollocks to that.
Nightmarish Uplay thing, which, to be honest, I mean, it looked really good, and I thought, yeah, I could go for that. And then I saw you logging out of Uplay afterwards, and I thought, hang on. And I honestly think that would put me off buying it entirely, which seems a bit petty, but I just don't like unnecessary log-on connect systems and DRM and all the rest of those bollocks. I mean, it's all right that Steam can deliver games, and that's fair enough. You put up with it a bit. I mean, I'm somewhat miffed that Skyrim has to go through Steam to do anything, but you know, when every publisher starts adding their own little third party utility, it all just gets a bit much, to be honest.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But it does look interesting, very, very graphically refined, and a sort of sci-fi setting. Was that colonizing a new world type of a thing?
No, it's Earth post ecological disaster with rising sea levels.
Oh, I thought the zoomed out map looked a bit like Indonesia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, bits which are uninhabitable have become very lush.
Okay.
And
so a whole new Eden starting again, yep. But with sci-fi technology to get it all up and going.
Yeah, so it's
reminded me a bit of an aquatic Alpha Centauri.
Yes.
In a way, but with a lot more city management and placing of buildings and so on.
Yeah. I'm building roads and stuff.
It looked good. I may overcome my aversion to Uplay to have a look. I don't know.
Yeah, so hopefully that's going to stay the same quality throughout the whole game.
I suspect
it will. I still haven't actually done what I like doing in these games, which is just bury myself for a day and build a big town.
It must have a free play mode where you just...
It's got an endless mode, which is what I assume that is.
Because you're sort of quite embroiled in some story mode thing.
Yeah,
there.
I'll go for the story mode because that's campaign, where all the tutorials are.
Oh, yes.
Effectively.
Learn what it all does.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Next. Well, right. FS 2013. Oh, yeah.
Is that another racing thing, is it?
No.
No?
That's Farming Simulator.
Oh, wow. We've been joking about getting one of these simulator games reviewed for a long time.
And it was sitting there on Steam for 20 quid, and I thought, why not?
Absolutely. So there's this big range of games which are essentially mundane simulations of real-life industries, and they've got quite a cult following from what I can understand.
Yeah, they sell quite well.
I was quite interested with Mining Simulator, the one about running a mine, because I actually have an academic background in some of that. I shan't bore you with the details, but basically I know how to use rock drills and explosives. I thought, let's see how accurate any of these things are. So you don't know a lot about farming, I suppose.
I know nothing about farming.
How do I mine for fish? Yeah. Well, tell me about it.
The game starts...
Yes.
...with a yard full of tractors and attachments.
Okay.
And there's a field, which is full of wheat.
Okay, so you're straight into harvest time then.
So you jump in the combine harvester.
The king of agricultural equipment.
It's not a very good one. You drive it around, you've got the ability to turn it on and off and raise and lower the equipment.
Uh-huh.
And then you have to line it up and get it all off the field by not going too fast. Driving backwards and forwards.
Yes, that mirrors the real life process quite a lot. Did you have a little a tractor with a trailer coming alongside with
you? No, because I was single playering it.
Oh.
If I was multiplayering it, somebody could have had that tractor for me.
Yes, multiplayer. Wow, so someone else can be do the truck to collect the grain out of the side side chute.
So I was having to I parked the truck at the side and I was having to go over to it and empty it.
Oh, that's very inefficient. Yeah. You know, in very large American agriculture, they tend to have GPS-driven fleets of those combine.
Yeah, they're automatic,
aren't they?
You just set them going and it follows the GPS.
That's very much the modern way of farming. My father has an agricultural background and I was chatting to him about this, and it's all becoming GPS-based these days. I mean, the farmer still has to sit in the tractor to oversee, but, you know, you can read a book or listen to a podcast or something.
Well, you could do that. You could hire a driver, in which case the computer takes over driving,
okay.
And you can read a book.
Good. So recreating the mindless tedium of ploughing 3,000 acres.
After I had emptied, cleared the field,
yes,
I took it all to the side. I put it all on my silo.
You remember to keep that bit, don't you? That's the important bit that you sell for money.
Yeah.
That's not just weeds.
I put it on the silo, then I got it out of the silo again because I thought I should probably sell this.
Yeah.
And then I drove around town for a while trying to find out where you sell grain.
Yeah.
Then I found where you sell grain.
The man from Tesco's came along, drove you into the ground with his aggressive bargaining that you had no say against.
Then I sold the grain.
He sold, right, okay.
Then in the shop.
Yes.
I went to the shop and I bought myself a couple of bits of gear. I bought myself a lawnmower.
A lawnmower?
A ride-on lawnmower.
It's going to take you a while to bring the wheat in.
And also I bought myself some cows and chickens.
Okay.
Because I figured cows and chickens are...
Did you then swap the cow for some magic beans?
No. Mm. And then I took the... Every 10 minutes, or you can make it 2 minutes if you change options, you get a mission to come up.
Missions?
Which is basically, there's an escaped elephant. You need to take a crate of peanuts somewhere so they can catch you. I don't know if the elephant's actually in game. Probably not.
Just
delivery. But I don't have a forklift that can load pallets.
Oh.
So I decided I needed to get a bit of a gear which could do some of these missions. So I got the lawnmower, which I then took to the golf course, and I kept having to do missions at the golf course to mow the lawn.
So you're not really farming at that point, are you? What you're doing there is running a landscaping side business just to keep the wolf from the door.
The thing is, because I had to do that, after I had cleared the field, I then ploughed the field, sowed seeds on the field. I should probably fertilise the field, what I could be asked at that point.
Yeah. And I harrow it as well. Did you do that?
Which one's the harrow?
It's like a long rake thing with a load of angular bits of metal on the back. Basically, you do that, that sort of aerates the soil and breaks it up from big clods before you sow it.
Yes, I may have done that one.
Fair enough.
It was quite late at night at this stage. Yeah.
You'd have to be quite drunk to be playing it at all, I think, to be honest. But
maybe. Mm.
And then once you've done that, you then have to wait for about 6 months.
How does it handle that? But it still hasn't grown, and I was doing an awful lot of mowing in the meantime.
Yeah, running your gardening business in the side to keep yourself. Well, I think that's generally the time you're supposed to spend looking after cattle and livestock and stuff. I don't know if you're on a purely arable basis.
I need to get a couple of crops in, so I've got enough money to buy new gear, basically.
It sounds riveting. We take the mick out of these things, and we call them not real games and everything, but is it enjoyable in any sense?
If you like the order...
Yeah.
Then yes, the creating order out of stuff.
Well, that's essentially what farming is. Yeah, creating food from order out of nature.
It's soothing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's sort of downtime kind of game.
It's not awful. I'd say that. Yeah. It's playable.
Production values, is it?
Reasonably good.
Very well detailed graphically and so. There must be some big company or two out there that just churn these things out.
They're both German.
I've seen loads of different sort of commonplace day real life industries with their equivalent logging and mining and all this sort of stuff. And they're all out there.
It was remarkably better than I thought it would be.
Okay.
Much better.
Okay. Well, I'll have to try and get that mining one and have a look, see if that's any interesting at all.
You probably want to see when this year's mining one's coming out.
Is it a lot like... It reminds me of the old Microsoft Flight Sim sort of thing.
Yeah.
They have a very similar style of art to the boxes and everything.
They do,
as well,
don't they?
And there's always one every year or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So probably not a huge recommendation, but interesting.
It's worth a look.
As far as farming
goes. If
you
get a cheap one when game goes bankrupt next.
Yeah, when the next high street entertainment industry disappears.
That was last week, wasn't it, when HMV went?
I think Game bought a load of HMVs.
They're talking about it because when you don't have money...
Seems bold. Seems quite courageous, considering I imagine Game will be next.
Well, especially the local games, two doors down from HMV.
Yeah,
so that's about it for games.
Okay, fair enough.
I also watched Dread.
Okay.
Which I didn't get to see in the cinema because it was only in 3D, and I don't watch 3D films because they make my eyes hurt.
Right. This is the new one, not the Stallone one, of course.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is the Carl Urban one, who is brilliant. Carl Urban is brilliant in anything he does.
I remember a lot of people saying that the Stallone one was all right until he took the helmet off, and then it just goes to hell quite quickly.
Yeah.
Does Carl Urban keep the helmet on, or do they attempt to make him a likeable character and everything?
There is no trying to make anyone a likeable character in this at all.
Okay. So you actually have a fair comic background with this Dread stuff.
I am reasonably familiar with the background of the Dread.
Satisfying?
It was very satisfying.
It was.
I don't know how great it's going to be if you don't know the character.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to get you to watch it.
I'll have to give it a borrow. Yeah. Is it for the fans, or does it stand alone, do you think?
I think it stands alone.
Okay.
It's a very violent film, and if you don't understand...
Dread is. Yeah.
Yeah, if you don't understand that Dread is a statement on why fascism's a bad thing...
Yes.
...then you might take away the wrong message from it.
It's a bit like the Ferrari with Starship Troopers.
Yeah. This is not a good thing.
Fascism is not good. Stop empathising with Doogie Howser.
And it's basically the idea... At the start, there's a thing. There's X number of crimes per minute, and they can respond to something like 4% of them.
God.
Yeah. The system is not working and is getting worse.
Right.
But then it basically turns into a fight up and down a tower.
Okay. Big block war thing.
Yeah. Hmm. You don't really have... It doesn't look like Mega City 1 has done. It's basically a normal flat city with large block buildings, not...
Because
there
was
quite a decent
CG work in the original, the Stallone Dread one.
Yeah, it's not like that.
No, okay.
But it's okay. I don't quite feel that it's right. And also the bike isn't right either. That looks a bit too sleek.
Details.
But beyond that, everything else is pretty much spot on.
Okay. Oh, I'll have to give that a borrow if you've got it on DVD. I must buy a Blu-ray player at some point.
They're about 50 quid now, you know.
I know.
You should also buy an HDTV.
I haven't got around to it yet. I know.
Yeah, so Dredd is good. I like Dredd. Everyone should watch it because it is good. And if you don't like it, then go away, read the last 30, 40 years worth of Dredd, and then watch it again.
Fair enough. I'd like to think there wasn't 30 years worth of background reading before you can appreciate this film properly. But,
no. And okay. Also, to be honest, some of the early Dredd stuff's a little bit ropey.
Okay, fair enough.
Read the last year's Dredd. That'll really help. Yeah.
Okay.
And lastly, they remade Yes, Prime Minister.
What?
And there's a new series of Yes, Prime Minister.
What? Why? We don't need Yes, Prime Minister anymore. We have the thick of it in this day
that
and age.
That is a very good point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Was that the main problem?
It's the original
your...
writers. Basically, they did a stage show. It was successful. Then they managed to turn it to a TV show with the same people. The same people of the TV of the stage show, not the TV show, because, of course,
that's just a proper official thing, then, yes. By the original. But times have moved on, haven't they?
Times have moved on. It completely doesn't take into account the thick of it happened.
Yes.
The thick of it has moved that particular idea onwards.
Well, you always get these interviews with politicians around both Yes Minister and the thick of it, and they're all saying how accurate it all is. But Yes Minister is a snapshot of British politics from the 70s, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which apparently was very accurate for its time. You know, the Thatcher government at the time thought that someone was leaking this
stuff. And
some
of them were.
to the scriptwriters. But that sort of paints a portrait of a bygone age, and the thick of it is much more accurate to how politics is conducted this day and age.
The big problem is, with recasting the people, they've got it hideously wrong.
And Paul Eddington and Nigel Hawthorne are very accomplished actors who absolutely captivate, you know, nailed those characters. And it must be a major problem trying to find anyone
Sir
who can
Humphrey,
get close.
To start
yeah,
with.
Sir Humphrey.
Hawthorne's... portrayal of that was very clipped speaking, good enunciation,
very clever delivery.
Yeah, very clever delivery. Could run through these massively long speeches,
sort of techno babble.
You wanted to listen to them to the end.
Yeah, yeah.
The new guy they've got, he's very smug. He plays it smug.
Yeah,
which
there's a lot of smugness in Hawthorne's portrayal of Sir Humphrey, but
it was more self satisfaction.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, more confidence.
He'll just be saying stuff, and it just comes over as slightly meaner, not
well. He'd often
ruthless.
Be rattled as well when Hacker gets the upper hand. So and also quite a wide range there.
When he got the big speech, he couldn't really pull it off in the same way, so it just wasn't as listenable.
Okay.
They've made Hacker a bit too intelligent. Because in the original one, he always thought he was in control. He always thought he was getting one
He was
one
very
up.
Rarely in control, but sometimes when he did manage to get the upper hand, it was brilliant. Yeah.
And it was purely through luck every time.
Yeah, yeah.
But he always thought he had the upper hand. But
somewhat gormless, yeah.
Yeah, but in this one, he actually had a speech about how a bit of Europe works.
I can't imagine Hacker being cleverer than Sir Humphrey working, which
no.
sounds
well,
like
not
what you've
clever,
got.
Just... Mm. Yeah, neither of them in the right role, and the dynamic doesn't work because of it.
Oh, dear.
It just doesn't quite gel, and it's got a hideous laugh track.
Oh.
Which is a really, really bad one. It may be people laughing live.
Well, certainly the original Yes Minister did have a laugh track.
Yeah, laugh tracks.
But I think that might have been a studio audience even, I don't know.
Laugh tracks are not a problem.
I know the thick of it doesn't have anything like that at all. It plays it very straight and is hilarious because of it.
Yeah, a laugh track is not a problem. It will make some shows work. Red Dwarf without a laugh track doesn't work, for instance.
Okay.
And, of course, there's that famous video somebody's done of Big Bang Theory without the laugh track, which is, of course, really isn't fair because there's gaps left for the laugh.
Oh, absolutely.
So there's joke, then pause.
Yeah, if you're writing a script for it and expecting laughs,
you have to pause.
Gags, you've got pauses.
Yeah, the laugh track in this is just too much, too loud, too after everything, even when it's not funny.
Yeah. Oh dear! Oh well, so a bit of a bad idea, really. All in
all. And I can see why the BBC passed on it.
Yeah. Oh, was it went straight to Dave or something?
Gold.
Okay, fair enough.
Yes, because we only have sensibly named TV stations now.
Good.
Yeah, and that's probably about it.
You've done a fair bit.
Yeah, it's been a busy week.
Yeah. Right, now we come to the part of the show which I like to call What's in the Bag, my lemon tea success of last week.
This appears to be a whole new feature
this
which I have been warned about.
Right. Okay, so coming back, Well, coming back to Guild Wars 2, then, right. So I've did the cooking profession in Guild Wars 2, and you go about the world and you gather up various exotic ingredients and you turn them into food in a cooking furnace.
Oh, God.
In Ore, one of the top far-end items that you can harvest is something called a lotus root, which grows on the edges of water, some sort of plant or orchid.
And you found
thing.
One?
And I actually found one in real life. I thought this was entirely made up by ArenaNet, which shows what a philistine I am. But I was in Morrison's yesterday. I came across this. There you go. Describe that to the listener.
Other baked lotus root chips. Ooh,
absolutely.
That's interesting.
So I saw that on the wall in the fruit and veg section. I thought, that's odd. Why are Morrison's doing Guild War 2 games guides in their produce section? That's a bit weird. So I picked the card up, had a read through it, didn't look too technical, and then I went and had a rummage around. And they actually have one of these. There we go. Have a rummage. Open up that bag. I've just handed him a carrier bag with a suspicious object inside it.
Carrier bag from the co-op.
I have carrier bags knocking about at home. That is a lotus root you got in your hand there. If you want to describe that to the listener.
It's slightly
Get it out of the bag. That's all right.
And slimy.
But these things are something I've been harvesting loads of. That you need 400 points in cooking to use them.
It's relatively hard.
Yeah. Oh, can you hear that knocking there?
Yeah.
It just amazed me this was a real thing. I thought ArenaNet had just made it up.
Seed poddy thing.
Yeah, it's about the size of a potato, similar exterior consistency and texture. Anyway, yep. So the recipe is for what else? What I've got in the box. This is the high point of the show. These have probably gone cold now, actually. I made them about an hour ago before I came over.
We've been recording for an hour.
Yeah. There we go. You have a go at those. I've already had some, so
they're meant to be crisps.
So these are oven baked lotus root chips. I'll just quickly go over the recipe. Yeah, they may have gone a bit soggy and cold. They're probably best straight out of the oven anyway. So preheat your oven to gas mark 6. Wash and peel the lotus root just like a potato. Slice into very thin rings. Now describe one of those rings to the listener.
It's a ring with lots and lots of holes in it.
Yeah, it's got this fantastic wheel-shaped cross-section. That's what the actual root has. And the icon in Guild Wars 2 shows this. And I thought, that's an odd thing. I'd never heard of it or come across it at all. Apparently on the display it says they come from China. I don't know if Wikipedia's got an entry on lotus roots. So slice it into thin rings, pop it into a large bowl of water with the lemon juice, stir well, the juice of one lemon in the water, stand for 5 minutes, bring a pan of lightly salted water to the boil, drain lotus roots cooking, boiling water for 2 minutes, drain well. So basically you're parboiling them, like you would with potatoes or roast parsnips or whatever. Then you mix together paprika, salt flakes, cumin seeds and sunflower oil, drizzle it over the lotus root, carefully toss them so they gain an even coating of oil, and slices arrange into a baking tray lined with non-stick baking parchment in a single layer. Then you bake for 15 minutes, turn them over, bake for another 15 minutes, and serve immediately. And there you go. So how does that taste? What you got there? I see you munching away on one.
They're
there.
Quite nice.
Quite brave. Okay. Come on, give me some descriptions. What are we getting there? Are we getting autumn earth? Trumpets?
They're not crispy at the moment.
No, they should be crispy. They were when they came out of the oven, but obviously we've been chatting for quite a while now, and they've gone a bit limp and cold. But
yeah.
What's the taste like?
A bit potato-y.
Yeah. Looking at the texture and the consistency and how you prepare them and stuff, I think you could use these anywhere you would use potato. You can probably boil and mash them. You can roast them in sections, I suppose. The internal structure means they'll probably boil much quicker than a potato because they've got holes down the centre of it all.
Because they taste the flavourings you've added.
It's basically paprika and cumin and salt as a sort of olive into an oil marinade, as it were. So that's your sort of flavour from it.
But they are really nice,
quite strong. They taste to me a bit a cross between coconut and potato. You're
getting coconut, isn't
yeah. So that's fantastic. I mean, I had never heard of these, and you know what? I'd never seen them in the Morrison's I go to until quite recently. So I reckon someone in their purchasing department plays Guild Wars 2. I'm hopefully looking to see if any Omnom berries exist in real life and are in the shop next time. But I think they actually may be made.
They
up
may
those.
Have made those up.
Yeah. So there we go. That concludes our cookery section. What did you learn this week?
I learned. You wait till I've just eaten one.
I'm gonna have a munch on these as well.
I've learned that farming is not the career for me.
I could have told you that. Long tales from my dad about how tedious it all is. And I learned how to make fried lotus chips, which apparently are a real thing, which I'm eating right now. So, do your spill.
We've got fish eating.
With your mouth full of lotus chips.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They are very Moorish.
They are quite Moorish, yes. You can find our blog on howtomurdertime.com. You can also find us on iTunes. And if you'd like to leave us a review on that, that'd be great, because it'll bump us up this stats a bit.
And what do points make?
Prizes.
Yeah.
You can also catch me on SciCon.net now.
What happened to .org? Did you get hacked? Or
no, we got the new bandwidth domain. We're now chasing down SciCon.com.
Someone sandbagging that.
Yeah,
okay.
For a lot of money.
Oh, dear.
I guess it was just us and a sceptical conference. Yeah. Where I do movieing up, which is the movie thing.
Mm-hmm.
Last week's was... What was last week's?
Star Wars.
Wasn't Star Wars, yes. What's Star Wars?
Which I still haven't listened to, sorry.
Yeah, don't worry, neither I. actually, I was there.
Did you like it?
Yes.
Spoilers.
Yeah. And this week's film is Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, wow.
Which I've never seen before.
I love that
really
film.
Have to watch it before
I've
tomorrow
I've seen
night.
It a few times. The hats are what really make it for that.
Okay.
For me, that film.
Yes, I've got the DVD over
watch
there.
Watch out for the hats.
Mm. Yeah, and... So I'm meeting Lotus.
Yum, yum.
Is there anything I missed? Can't remember now.
That's probably it. We should probably wrap up.
We should probably wrap up. And
see ya.
Finish eating. Goodbye.